The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
Wall Street has provided $15 million just in the last reporting period to the Secretary's super PAC.
I've taken them on. I took on the drug companies. I took on the insurance companies. In 2006, Senator Sanders supported indefinite detention for people facing deportation and stood with the Minutemen vigilantes.
No, I do not support vigilantes, and that is a horrific statement to make. And I said, welcome those children into this country. Secretary Clinton said, send them back.
The Koch brothers have just paid to put up an ad praising Senator Sanders.
The secretary says it doesn't influence her. Well, that's what every politician says who gets money from special interests.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Those, of course, sounds from last night's Democratic presidential debate in Miami, courtesy of Univision. Now, Bernie Sanders' unexpected win in Michigan this week has pollsters thinking that maybe they misunderstood the electorate there. And at the same time, that misunderstanding could play out in future voting states like Ohio and Illinois coming up just next week. But is there a bigger problem in election polling than just the one Michigan case? Response rates and sample sizes have plummeted in the last 20 years as fewer, especially younger voters, use the landline telephones that many pollsters use to reach voters. And conducting a poll costs more than ever. But the news media, the voters and the candidates, well, they stay hung up on the numbers.
CNN, he gets 15. That means 85%, based on what you're saying, of the people don't dig you, number one. Number one. Is that a correct statement? How do you get 50? Are you at 15 in the new CNN poll? Do you believe in CNN?
There's Donald Trump talking about his rival Senator Ted Cruz at the last Republican debate. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about how the news media covers polls. But first, was Michigan a fluke, or are pollsters really missing bigger trends as they try to adjust to new technology? Joining me now is Michael Ramlett, co-founder and CEO of Morning Consult, a technology company and public opinion polling firm based in Washington, D.C. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
So lessons learned after action review, I guess they call it. What did the pollsters get wrong in Michigan? How were they so very wrong and why?
I think what's amazing is we're not actually learning anything new. I think we actually knew this from 2012 as early as 2008, which is that live telephone and automated telephone polling is essentially on life support. You might as well pronounce it dead. Because at this point, you know, increasingly, there's fewer and fewer Americans are willing to answer their phones. 36% of Americans would respond to a poll in 1997. That was down to 9% in 2012. I have to imagine that is even lower today here in 2016. What we're finding is that the old school pollsters, the traditional way of doing it, doesn't work. And I think what's amazing to us, and you know, we're a technology company, we've had chances to collaborate with the New York Times, we do polling for Vox Media, for Fortune magazines, we're just shocked that it's taken this long for people to realize that maybe I can't continue to do something that's getting a worse and worse sample. And so to me, Michigan is just, it's not even the canary in the coal mine. Basically, they've been getting it wrong for the better part of the last 6 months. Almost all of these polls underestimated Donald Trump. None of them were there early to identify the surge with Bernie Sanders. I think what you're finding is just, you know, these are more like weather forecasters than meteorologists. And it turns out there's an actual science behind polling.
And they got the Iowa caucuses wrong as well. We shouldn't forget that.
Yeah, I mean, the caucuses are always tough because those are states where you're really focused on the turnout models. But a state like Michigan, you have a pretty diverse state and it's a large population. So they really should be able to do larger samples. I mean, basically what's happening, you kind of introed it at the beginning, is that with fewer people answering the phone, it's more and more expensive to conduct polling because you have to call more and more households. Well, if it's more and more expensive, then you're going to get fewer and fewer people in these samples. So pollsters are oftentimes only interviewing 400 Republicans, which means you have a bigger margin of error. But also there's this issue of they're not interviewing enough African-American, Hispanic, Arab-Americans. And as a result, when they go to then weight the samples, so essentially for your audience, pollsters weight a sample to either what the current population survey is, what they think a likely voter model is. But when they go to weight the sample, they're drawing upon maybe 10, 15, 20 African-Americans who responded to that poll and then weighting it up. So it's not surprising, I think, that we see increasingly pollsters using the old school methodology or finding it harder and harder to go find representative samples.
How should voters, viewers, digest all of this? The news coverage won't go away. We can't say that polls are useless because they're not completely useless, but we also can't say they're dispositive. So how should we watch them?
I think that you have to focus on the innovative side of where public opinion polling and market research is going. I think what you're going to find is over time here, the polling and market research market, it's going to get better with election forecasting. But because it's less expensive to do this online and through mobile polling, you're also going to have a more diverse set of topics. American public should be really excited about where polling's going. But at the end of the day, they just have to be critical. They can't rely on, oh, I'm just going to vote because, you know, I'm told that this is who's expected to win. They have to vote because this is who they support and who they believe in. And I think what we actually see is that despite all of this media chaos here about, you know, there's too much reporting on polling, what we find is that people don't necessarily shift. So we did a major project with 538, which is Nate Silver's publication, mm-hmm. does a lot of election forecasting. What we did was we re-interviewed the same Republicans before the Iowa caucuses, after the Iowa caucuses, before the New Hampshire primary, after the New Hampshire primary. You might expect that because the polls were wrong about Trump's support in Iowa, that all of a sudden Trump voters would then shift. And what we found is there wasn't dramatic shifts. So perhaps maybe the polls are just really good at providing content for on-air segments and not actually instructive in how voters are likely to move.
And so if voters are watching polls on cable news, grain of salt is a cliche. Don't let them sway you. Maybe the methodology is flawed. Michael Ramlett, co-founder and CEO of Morning Consult. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
You've been weighing in on political polls and whether they influence your vote.
Sometimes people wait to see what other people are thinking as a shortcut to making their own decisions and actually reviewing all the facts and coming up with decisions on their own.
From Olympia, Washington, polls may influence me subconsciously. I feel they do hurt the process because they encourage herd mentality and they discourage critical thinking.
Political polls don't affect the way I vote because I research the candidates for myself. However, I fear that polls often do influence the way others vote. Many people want to be on the perceived winning team. For this reason, I'm not sure that they are helpful.
We got this from Minnesota. Polls don't influence me, but they do influence my husband. He voted for Donald Trump at the caucus because, quote, he's going to win anyway. I can't help but think that this is how a lot of Americans vote. I don't believe you should vote for who you think is going to win. You should vote for whomever you think is best for the job. You can weigh in on this or any conversation. The number is 8778-MY-TAKE. You can leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. As unpredictable and unpredictive as political polling can be, that doesn't stop the news media from thriving on it.
We've heard a lot this week about the latest Gallup poll, which shows Governor Romney with his greatest national lead to date over the president. And for the first time, it shows Governor Romney's support tops 50%. That's brand new, with his lead over the president outside the margin of error.
Fox News' Shepard Smith there just 2 weeks before Election Day in 2012. Exact same issues as today. Why was the polling so bad then? Why didn't Mitt Romney perform as well as the polls said he would? Now, everyone in the news media said maybe we shouldn't rely on polls so much for reporting on these elections. Lessons learned? Not really. It seems like lessons repeated. Here we are again in the 2016 election cycle, asking a lot of the same questions. And beyond how the news media covers the polls, do polls simply measure how people really feel? Or do they have their own influence over the very voters they're supposed to be sampling? Michael Traugott is professor at the Center for Political Studies at the University of Michigan. Professor Traugott, welcome.
Hello.
We're in a situation where everybody seems to know that individual polls especially, but polling in general, are not always terribly reliable, but they get reported as news every single day. So what's wrong with the incentives here?
Well, like any other consumer product, in polling you get what you pay for. And there are pressures, economic pressures, on news organizations who are the primary sponsors of polls to cut costs or keep them to a minimum, and this often affects the quality of the polling, and that in turn can affect the quality of the estimates.
And once the polls are out, is it simply the case that it's a quick, easy headline, discussion topic, go with it, report the poll?
Well, there's been a tendency over the last few decades for election coverage to continually emphasize what we call horse race journalism, reporting on who's ahead and who's behind. And polling naturally fits into that tendency because the data show not only the current standing of the candidates, but how it might have shifted since the last poll was conducted.
Except that often it doesn't necessarily reflect the current standing of the candidates, and there can be this feedback effect. And I want to ask you about that. Do polls merely reflect public opinion? It seems like they do a lot to shape it. I always notice how hard campaigns work sometimes to show reporters that they're leading in the polls. They want people to know that.
Well, it's always better to be ahead than behind. And sometimes polls are used strategically by the campaigns. The central issue with polling is that properly conducted and reported, they give the public a voice in the campaign coverage that otherwise they wouldn't have. Typical coverage would involve interviews with political leaders and strategists who obviously have a partisan message. If the polls focused on issues and how the candidates were, how the electorate was responding to the candidates, that would be a positive thing. But if they just report who's ahead and who's behind, that isn't very useful.
But what do we know about the way polling results affect voter behavior, sort of the inverse of what you'd expect? When somebody's way ahead in the poll, what do we know about how people react to that?
When the polls show that one candidate is way far ahead, they can affect turnout because the supporters of the winning candidate feel as though their vote isn't necessarily as valuable as it might be, and it's not necessary to go to the polls. But on the other hand, if the polls show that it's a very tight race, they can stimulate turnout. It all depends upon the context of the given race.
Is there also sort of a bandwagon effect that we know about where if people see one candidate ahead, they kind of psychologically want to be on the winning team?
There are actually two effects, Todd. One is a bandwagon effect and one is an underdog effect. We can measure these in laboratory experiments. The bandwagon effect is the tendency of some people, usually uncommitted and uninvolved voters, to support the candidate who's ahead. And the underdog effect is the consequence of voters supporting somebody who is behind. They're very difficult to measure in the real world because, of course, they counteract each other in a particular poll.
So, Professor, what do you do? What's your advice for a news consumer watching poll after poll today, questioning maybe the accuracy of those polls and not wanting to be coerced into a bandwagon effect?
One point is that we're trying to inform citizens to the best of our ability about how to interpret poll results and what kinds of things to look for in the methodology. It's just as important to be educating reporters about what good polls are in terms of their methodology and trying to keep the bad polls out of the news stream.
Michael Traugott, professor at the Center of Political Studies at the University of Michigan. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Earlier this week, WNYC and The Nation magazine's new podcast, There Goes the Neighborhood, brought us voices from the quickly changing neighborhoods in Brooklyn, New York. We also heard from a lot of you in cities all across the U.S.
My name is Adrian from Overtown in Miami, Florida.
Beth from Portland, Oregon.
This is Eric Hooper, Cleveland, Ohio.
This is Jessica from Jersey City.
And my name is Danette from Hinesville, Georgia. And I believe that gentrification is a four-letter word.
Gentrification is almost complete in my neighborhood.
When we moved here, we had a house for $700 per month. Now those houses, one bedrooms, are going for $1,500.
I moved into the Tremont area back in 1966. We were the third black family in the area. Since that time, I've seen white flight and now reverse white flight.
The kinds of stores and the kinds of opportunities there are for small business to thrive, it's really frustrating, and I'm actually considering selling and moving.
Well, today we go out to the West Coast, the city of Oakland, where gentrification is happening and neighborhoods are changing fast. The city now ranks fifth among the nation's most expensive rental markets. Devin Katayama is a reporter for KQED covering the East Bay, and he says pressure from the housing crisis in San Francisco has driven a lot of people across the Bay looking for new neighborhoods in West Oakland. And that small migration brings with it a lot of cultural and economic pressures West Oakland just hasn't seen before.
West Oakland all of a sudden has become this really unique space for both people moving in, building new houses, renovating houses, but also a place that has a lot of history in Oakland. You know, it's a place where blues and jazz greats came to play. And this is a place with a lot of history, and that's kind of butting up against the newcomers coming in.
Now, there's a lot of new money starting to pour in to the neighborhood, as you point out. And you also have a main character here, a fellow named Tony. He's got the Revolution Cafe, and Tony's a person who's trying to build a business while all of this money is coming in from the outside.
Right now, we're inside the Revolution Cafe. It was once called the Revolution Cafe, and it's been here for a while. It was a cafe. It was like a community hub, and we plan to bring it back.
Devin Katayama, tell us a little bit about Tony and what he's up to there.
Well, the cafe sits on 7th Street, and that is the strip that used to have all these clubs. It used to be a place where African Americans could go, could spend time, be entertained. Then there was a lot of disruption to the neighborhood. There was a freeway that divided West Oakland. There was a giant post office hub that kind of basically raised a bunch of houses, made them leave. And then, of course, you heard that BART train going by, an elevated BART train that just really ruined the neighborhood. So what he's talking about when he's saying he wants to bring it back is that he wants to make that place the place that it once was. He wants to build, starting with that cafe, the neighborhood up from the ground up with the community support to make that strip relevant again. And of course, he's kind of butting up against the people who currently live there. He's butting up against a timeline which he thinks is really tight. And he mentions that. He knows that his time is limited, and he's scared of that.
They're going to get it ready. But who are they getting it ready for? And we would like to be a part of the people that they're getting it ready for and be a part of the people that are going to be the ones to help get it ready.
Devin, I live in Washington, D.C., where gentrification is happening rapidly as well. And in so many cases, people like Tony see their businesses shot to the side when Target or Best Buy or a fancy eyewear store comes in. It's great. It's clean. People shop there, but it's not local.
It's not local. And what's interesting about West Oakland is yet you haven't seen those big box developers come in yet. You haven't really even seen a lot of business come in altogether, even the local business. So Tony is in this really interesting time period right now of thinking that if he could just establish the cafe, make it a place that's already there once those other stores come, that maybe he has a chance to make it.
So let's talk about the practicalities of Tony getting his foothold, essentially, so that he's established that by the time all the development happens, he can't be pushed out. What does that mean for him in terms of dollars and cents, in terms of rent?
Right now, he's being supported by the landlord to rent the property for low rent. And that is the one thing that allows him to do what he's doing. That property owner who I've talked to is deciding to sell the property. She doesn't know exactly when that's going to happen. Neither does Tony. But that is essentially what's allowing him to stay there. Now, if he wants to build the property, I've talked to other folks who have made it, you know, who have been successful in West Oakland. I've talked to city leaders. They say that Tony needs to reach out to more community partners. That could include nonprofits that have a name in Oakland. That could include other community groups that could help build that cafe and make it something, make it bigger than what it is. Right now, he's really doing some grassroots stuff and sending out emails and Facebook postings. He's having these meetings in the cafe, but he's not including a wider reach. And I think that's one thing that a lot of folks say he needs to do in order for the cafe to even have a chance.
And it seems like Tony Coleman knows that time is really of the essence here.
We have so much potential here, but things are going at such a fast pace that may be the downfall of us, is because we're not able to do things in a fast enough time period.
Devin, what are the neighbors saying about this development, maybe about Tony's efforts to have this established foothold in the community? Are they frequenting his cafe? Does he have any sense that his cafe will sort of become a rallying point for the people who live in West Oakland?
He really believes that. He also says he sees the writing on the wall, meaning that he thinks eventually he'll be forced to move. Time is running out. If we want to capitalize on people who haven't moved in yet, big businesses that haven't moved in, now is the time to do it. So you're seeing a lot of small little projects. You're seeing some individual efforts to, you know, stake their claim in a community like West Oakland before all this pressure really comes there and you start to see some major changes.
West Oakland is yet another community in yet another city in the United States where gentrification is happening before our very eyes. Devin Katayama is a reporter for KQED. He's witnessed the front lines between a community trying to survive and new investment coming in. Devin Katayama, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is David from Denver, Colorado. And I did live at one point in Long Beach, California, in a section that some people may have said was undergoing gentrification. And the thing I noticed at the time is that if you had a impoverished, unsuccessful neighborhood, I mean, meaning one with high crime and infrastructure problems, what was called gentrification was a very positive force for that area.
David got to us through Anchor, and we got this from Jersey City, New Jersey. I was a gentrifier in the late 90s, and now the neighborhood is being double gentrified. If I wanted to move into my place now, I wouldn't be able to afford it. And we want you to join the conversation. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. For a complete list of all the ways you can take part, check out the Connect with The Takeaway button over at the website.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Earlier this week on The Takeaway, there goes the neighborhood producer Rebecca Carroll joined me. She talked about gentrification, and she said that gentrification is about a lot more than affordable housing and real estate.
We're so behind on that in terms of race and racism, how to talk to each other. And that, to me, is so at the heart of building a neighborhood and a community.
Well, it's an issue in housing, but also at work, how to talk to each other about the things we don't want to talk about, especially when it comes to race. Now, this is one of the issues tackled by Truth Be Told. It's a special radio series from KQED and PRI. And host Joshua Johnson says sometimes personal experiences with racially charged situations are the very hardest ones to talk about.
Those are the ones where we find that you get the most insights out of them. That's why we're taking on those stories in particular, asking listeners to drive the show with their personal stories of racially charged encounters and then trying to unpack them to figure out what happened and maybe what could have happened differently or better.
Now, you have a character in your first installment. Her name's Annie. I take it Annie's not her real name, right?
She asked us to use her middle name to protect her future career prospects because she's still working in the industry that her story is about.
Okay, now who is Annie and why did you include her?
Annie works in Silicon Valley, got a prospect for a job, a recruiter contacted her, saw her resume on LinkedIn, and apparently made her feel like she was just a shoo-in for this job. So she went into the interview feeling super confident.
Then Annie arrives at her prospective place of work, and let's listen.
The receptionist said, "Now you are," and I mentioned who I was, and she said, "Oh, okay." And the person who was in the office came out, and she looked at me, never said hello, and just started to, she mumbled something, and she was just walking down the corridor. And so I kind of yelled out, "Oh, should I follow you?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, 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 come on."
It seems like she perceived a HR person or whoever was interviewing her was shocked to see her in some way.
Yeah, Annie is African American. And as she told us the story, it seemed like the people who interviewed her for the job did not expect to be interviewing somebody black.
And so the interview went pretty well, and then Annie actually heard from the recruiter the next day.
Saying, "Gosh, I don't know what went wrong. Did things go okay?" I said, "Yeah, I think they went really well." He said, "Because she felt that you were not the right fit."
Joshua, what does that mean?
A lot of people in tech have talked about hiring employees that they feel like they would want to go have a beer with. Now, there is some merit to this because the culture of a Silicon Valley startup is one of the big selling points for new talent. The flip side of it is a number of people of color have said that the right fit often involves people who look like you, who reflect your own worldview. So the issue here is that this idea of the right fit might have meant culture in terms of race and ethnicity.
Well, let's go back to where we began, which is with Annie and what she took away from her experience with this job that she never got.
A lot of things go through your mind. You wonder, gee whiz, was that the reason? But I'm pretty adamant now that I'd much rather have people go to my website, and if they're comfortable, great. And if they're not, wonderful, because then I don't have to waste your time. You don't have to waste mine.
Joshua, she's saying, look at me from a distance first. Make sure you're okay with it before you waste my time. It's unbelievable.
Well, you know, I've talked to a couple people about this, and there's some logic to that. One person I interviewed about Annie's story said that may not be such a bad thing to kind of allow people to confront that bias without you there, before you become part of the interaction. And then once we get in the room, there's the pressure of being the one. You know, tokenism is a real thing. You know, I'm African American, and if I was working in a company where I was the black guy, like the one, me and Willie the janitor, and there was nobody else, the company's efforts to diversify could begin to feel like it's my responsibility, like it's my job to help bring more black people in the company. Some folks are cool with that. Some folks are not. And for an employee of color to move into a space that is predominantly white, all of these issues come up.
Joshua Johnson from KQED. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
Those are the voices of a handful of the approximately 11,000 migrants trapped on the Greek-Macedonian border, which has just been sealed off this week as conservative European leaders successfully pushed for the closure of one of the major migrant routes into Central Europe. It's called the Balkan Trail. That closure comes just as a major deal between the EU and Turkey to stem the flow of migrants out of Greece is in the works. Speaking on German radio, Chancellor Angela Merkel condemned the sealing off of the Balkan Trail, saying it's a unilateral decision that's not, quote, sustainable or lasting. For a fuller picture of this week's developments, we go to Valentina Popp. She's reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Valentina.
Thanks for having me on the show.
In a week where we saw a putative deal between Turkey and the EU on migration, and now this new development, it seems like things are shifting nearly every day.
They are. According to EU officials here in Brussels, it's more like the pieces coming together in what they call a comprehensive strategy. Now, if that's really the case, or just them having different strands the countries were pulling at, and now they're trying to put it all together, remains to be seen. Also, it's not clear yet what exactly the details of this deal with Turkey are. We only have the rough outlines from Monday. But definitely the message this week is that the route that has been established since last summer through the Balkans, from Greece to the Balkans, through Austria, all the way to Germany and the Scandinavian countries, is now closed. Apart from the humanitarian crisis that is developing in Greece, this could also lead to alternative routes. And interior ministers are here in Brussels today discussing this scenario that migrants might take another route via Albania and then cross the Adriatic Sea to Italy.
So as we look at the puzzle pieces and the map of Central Europe, the sealing of the border between Greece and Macedonia seems to be of a piece with the larger agreement that people who come through Turkey to Greece will go back, and therefore it
exactly.
all fits together to seal the route.
Exactly. They want to send the message that there should be no more illegal crossings from Turkey to Greece, that there will be a chance for refugees to get resettled to Europe legally if they wait for a due process in Turkey. Obviously, Turkey has 2.7 million, so the tens of thousands that might be considered to come to Europe will be way lower than the million that made its way last year to Europe. But this is the message, because in a lot of European countries, there's simply no more political and public acceptance for another massive wave of migrants, who most of them might be refugees, but the countries were overwhelmed. They didn't cope with all the people coming in. They didn't know who is coming. So this has created also a lot of angoisse and fears among the population.
And yet, as we said earlier, German Chancellor Angela Merkel condemned that sealing of the border between Greece and Macedonia. So this seems to be having an unpredictable effect on the local politics of each of the participating countries.
Yes, she never approved of this step. However, she never told Austria and the Balkans to open the route again either, because that would be tantamount to political suicide for her, as this measure is actually helping Germany receive way fewer migrants than they have before the route was closed. So she's very uncomfortable with the measure. She can't be seen publicly as endorsing it, but she's not stopping it either.
New developments each day as Europe maneuvers along individual borders and with grand deals with other countries like Turkey to try to stem the flow of migrants from the war in Syria and Iraq. Valentina Popp, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. And from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Our Canadian friends, we are two different countries, but days like this remind us that we're like one big town, and we reaffirm that Americans and Canadians will always be there for each other. Welcome to the United States. Bienvenue, mes amis.
In Washington, D.C. today, Pennsylvania Avenue is festooned with maple leaf flags, and at the White House, Northern Coldwater Halibut and Yukon potatoes are on the menu, all because newly elected Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in town for a state dinner with the Obamas, the first state dinner for a Canadian Prime Minister in 19 years. That's right, 19 years since these two very best of friends have just sat down together, you know, just caught up. I know how it is. Hey, I lived in Canada for 5 years myself, even went to school with Justin Trudeau. It's just, you know, we never talk anymore. So we thought this would be the perfect time to check in with our northern friends. There are big issues to talk about, oil and war. But hey, when you're this close in a relationship, you can't let the little issues fester either. You gotta talk out the small stuff too. So we have Diane Francis. She's author of Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country. She's also editor-at-large for the National Post in Canada. She joins me from Toronto. Hi, Diane.
Hello.
19 years. Why so much time since the last state dinner?
Well, the relationship has been as frosty as Canada's climate. I mean, between Bush's Iraq war, which we took a pass on, and the bad relationships that resulted from that, and then Keystone, it's been chilly.
And is it because the new Liberal PM, Justin Trudeau, has been elected that the thaw is possible now?
Well, it is, because I think one of the first phone calls he had with Obama was to be told that Keystone was going to be nixed. And he didn't freak out. He said he was disappointed, but he understood America can do what America wants to do. So he was very gracious, as Canadians always are. And so then the invitation was put in the mail a couple of weeks later.
Just like that. Americans might be less thrilled, however, when they learn that Canada actually withdrew its F-18 fighters from the fight against ISIS, refusing to help us in the bombing in Iraq and Syria anymore.
That's disappointed a number of Canadians as well. We only had 6 jets there. We have a tiny, tiny military. But, you know, they have stepped up and tripled the number of trainers on the ground who are helping the Kurds. So they're doing their bit. That's what they're saying.
But what did the Canadian government give as a reason? I mean, Canada doesn't involve itself militarily in all U.S. operations, but they were involved in this one and then pulled back.
Well, you know, it's a different prime minister, a different attitude toward the threat in the Middle East. This guy is a much more peacenik type prime minister who doesn't see that it's as much of a problem, and he's not, you know, as militaristic as the other fellow was.
So what happens to American and Canadian relations when the price of oil is this low? $40 a barrel. I mean, we trade a great deal of petroleum with Canada, take a lot of crude from Canadian oil fields. It's just not worth anything right now.
No, it isn't, and that's very sad. And the oil sands has been rejected because of the Keystone rejection. So all of that is a very big concern, because a big underpinning for our economy is oil. And since oil is priced, you know, the oil price has collapsed, our dollar has gone down with it, actually in tandem, because it's known as a petrocurrency. So the Canadian dollar, which was, you know, mightily trading at par with the U.S. dollar only 3 years ago, is now in the 60s. It's pretty disastrous if you want to take a vacation in Florida, which a lot of Canadians do.
Well, there's big money at stake there. But Diane Francis, you know, when two countries are as close as ours, there are always lots of little issues boiling below the surface that we have to discuss. What's going on with milk, with dairy? I know that this is a longstanding bit of contention between Canada and the U.S.
Well, we do our dairy sector and our poultry sector differently than free trade would like it, and than the Americans would like it. So we have a closed shop. We have a closed shop for dairy and eggs and chickens and turkeys, and we don't let Americans export into our market, nor do we export into yours, to be fair. So we all pay a little bit more for that stuff so we can keep a few farmers employed. It's a very controversial farming sector, and it's a constant irritant with the Americans. There's other things, too. We can't sell softwood lumber to the extent we want to in your country, and we can't sell beef and pork sometimes. So these are the things that, you know, bug the two countries and the irritants that are ongoing. But, you know, it's not like Macedonia and Greece.
It's not like Macedonia and Greece, but still a bit of protectionism between the two sides. I want you to listen to Stephen Kelly. He's a professor at Duke University. I spoke to him back over the summer about a land dispute at Machias Seal Island off the coast of Maine.
There was a report out of one of the Canadian news magazines that suggested that war was imminent. It's not that bad, but there is definitely a feeling that there's a new element in the fishery this summer.
Diane Francis, Justin Trudeau and President Obama are going to have to get serious about this bona fide land dispute at Machias Seal Island off of New Brunswick.
Yeah, I think they should have a boxing match. I mean, this is so picayune. To even distinguish it by calling it a war would be, you know, a lot of Canadians don't even know about this. And, you know, the waters are tricky, because if it's offshore, you have a 200-mile or 200-kilometer limit. And, you know, where does the line get drawn? There's a big dispute, a much bigger dispute in the Beaufort Sea between Alaska and Canada over oil fields around Prudhoe and stuff like that because of the same issue. So these are the things that go on. But, you know, it's a pretty good relationship.
Yeah, now all of this stuff may disappear in importance when the massive migration wave comes of all the Americans who swear they're leaving for Canada if Donald Trump is elected president, or alternatively, probably if Hillary Clinton is elected president. I hope you're ready.
Well, just a minute. This is 34 million people up here, and we're all Democrats. I'm a conservative in the Canadian political scene, but that puts me left to the Democrats. I like our universal health care system, and I like a lot of the social democratic traditions that we have here, and so does Bernie Sanders. Clinton is moving toward Bernie, and so, you know, we're all kind of getting in sync. Trump is another matter.
I would have thought that Ted Cruz was the favorite son in Canada. He was born there after all.
He's a denier. He's denied being Canadian. He's denied it. And he took up American citizenship without keeping the Canadian, which is, by the way, what you can do if you want to.
Are Canadians enjoying the election down here?
It's the best reality show on TV. Every week somebody's voted off the island. We really enjoy it. I mean, you know, we're on the other side of the fence looking over and seeing what this noisy, interesting neighbor is doing all the time. And it's quite terrific. Bernie Sanders, perfect.
You guys love him.
We'd love him. And Hillary, too. I mean, Democrats are, this is a country of Democrats.
Well, then there's no doubt that there's a lot for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and President Obama to chew over during their state dinner and in the Oval Office. Diane Francis, author of Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
There's some things we will probably never agree on. Whose beer is better? Who's better at hockey? Where's the Stanley Cup right now?
What is this relationship worth if you can't take a jab at Canada once in a while? Love to do it. Here's something to take with you today. William Shakespeare, who died 400 years ago this April, left behind nearly 40 plays and 150 sonnets, but none of his handwritten documents survive. But there's a new discovery by a handwriting expert and curator of manuscripts at the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington. She found a detailed account from an audience member who saw A Winter's Tale at the Globe Theater way back in 1611. A guy named Simon Forman, he wrote, "Beware of trusting fiend beggars and fawning felons." You see, we thought that that line was fawning fellows, but the script is now changed thanks to a centuries-old handwritten note from the very theater. Thank you so much for listening to our words, words, words. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and LegalZoom, offering resources to help ensure the last wishes of individuals are upheld through last wills, living trusts, and powers of attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And from Staples, with printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.